Hi, and welcome to the Sports Info Solutions Baseball Podcast. I'm Mark Simon, joined by our producer, Justin Stein, to start things out. We've got a great show, packed show. First up, we've got Royal center fielder Kyle Isbell, then baseball writer Daniel Epstein, and then SIS operations analyst Brandon Tu in a new segment that we've started up here. Justin, I know that I enjoyed the very beginning and the very end of the Kyle Isbell interview. There was some good stuff in between, too, but what are some of the things the listeners should be paying attention to?
Yeah, the thing I really liked about the Isbell interview is he really kind of dives deep into talking about his process defensively. He talks about how he takes routes, how he judges the ball off the bat. He goes into it when he talks about catching made against Marcus Semien. And I think another thing he talked about, and he said this several times throughout the interview, and other guys have said this as well, he talks about during batting practice going out there, and that's where he practices getting reads on the ball. And I really like that. You know, back in my playing days when we had batting practice, it was more just standing around talking to your buddies and chasing balls down after the fact. So I think that's really good advice for young players. Take batting practice seriously. Work on your game. You know, that's the difference between being a professional and being an amateur.
Next up, we've got Daniel Epstein, who's a baseball writer, baseball prospectus. I feel like he could work here very easily if he wasn't already a teacher. And he talks about a few different articles he's written. Again, give us a little tease on him.
Yeah, the articles that he's written are interesting and definitely worth checking out. My favorite part of the interview was when he talked about some of the projects he's done on his own. I'll let him describe those in a little bit more detail, but it was stuff that we do at SIS, or similar stuff, and he did it all on his own. And really interesting things that he looked at. And one of the things I think is maybe something we could look at that we don't crack necessarily exactly how he did, but it's interesting. I'll leave that tease out there.
Lastly, we're joined by Brandon Tu, who's one of your colleagues. He's an operations analyst for us. We're starting a new segment where we're going to have a different person each week come on and talk three things that they find particularly interesting. And Brandon came very well prepared.
Yeah, he always does. And Brandon's our international expert. But I actually thought the most interesting part of his talk was when he talked about the college players. I'm a big draft junkie, maybe not quite as in the weeds as he is, but hearing all the players he mentioned and kind of how he evaluates those guys was definitely the favorite part of that interview for me.
He had two very good college baseball insights. One having to do with defense, and then one, as you said, having to do with quality of player, which was pretty cool. All right, Justin, thank you. Let's get to it. For our first major league player interview of the season, we wanted to talk to someone who's on a team that's off to a good start. And so we're joined by Royal center fielder Kyle Isbell. Since the start of the season, he's third among center fielders in defensive runs saved. Hi, Kyle.
How you doing?
Good. So let's talk and start by talking about what we always ask players when they come on, their origin story. What's the earliest great defensive play that you can remember making?
Oof. Earliest great defensive play. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, like, before games, there's not, like, many things I remember. But growing up with my dad, we would do this thing called impossibles. We would go out, and he said he did it with his dad, and he would basically just throw the ball, and you would just go dive and make a play. And he would just do it over and over and over and over again until I said I'm tired, and then he would still do more. And then that's just kind of, whenever he got home from work, that was just our thing. Like, we would just go do impossibles. He would just throw it as far or as close as he can, and I would just have to react and go after it and go get it.
Or was that like, all right, you got to sprint and dive for it? Or was that like hop over a fence and try and catch it? What did that look like?
No, that was just like open grass, just like sprint and dive for it, wherever it was at.
Cool. And where was that? Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Fontana, California. Yeah, we just a park right by our house. We would always do it, or in the backyard, wherever.
Awesome. And I would imagine that that's what helped you get off to a very strong start in your major league career defensively. And there's something in particular that I wanted to kind of focus on to start. In the StatCast metrics, they have you as being one of the best players in baseball at getting really great jumps, meaning that like first second and a half, first 3 seconds, you're really good. And I watched a catch you made on Luis Robert in the right center gap a couple of weeks ago that I felt like kind of demonstrated that pretty well. And it's pretty much like you, Dalton Varsho, who are the two guys that are kind of like the standard setters at that. Besides playing impossible, how did that come to be?
I think over time, especially in like batting practice, really pay attention to guys' swings. Being able to read swings and the different pitches guys throw, you're going to get certain outcomes based on guys' swing paths. So you can pretty much bank on playing your odds. You can pretty much bank on see where the ball is going before a guy even makes contact.
How long does something like that take to pick up on?
I mean, that's just something I've been doing really my whole life, just reading swings and just reacting off the bat. I was an infielder growing up my whole career. The same thing, playing shortstop. You're reading swings off the bat and trying to get the quickest jump. And then when I moved to the outfield, instead of being 130 feet away from the hitter, now I'm 300 feet away from the hitter. So if you have those same instincts that you had as an infielder, you have that much more time in the outfield.
Those same stats with route running, they don't necessarily put you as high up. And I watched a pretty fair number of balls that you catch. And I know that and this is sometimes where the stats can kind of like maybe not tell the whole story. The stats are looking for you to run a straight line. You don't necessarily take straight line paths to the ball from what I've seen. Am I right in how I kind of assess that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I always try to get better at. But there's so many things that go into it that your brain processes when a guy makes contact with the ball. I mean, the wind is a factor. The sun's a factor. There's so many things that how you perceive the ball, what kind of spin, like you can't necessarily see the spin off the bat right at contact. You can just kind of see the direction. So as you make your move through the direction, then you kind of figure out which way the ball's spinning. And that's probably when the route's kind of getting altered, because if you're running in a straight line every single time, and the ball's not hit straight every single time.
Your first instinct is generally, with all the data points that are kind of going through your head, like really quickly, is generally like back or in kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah, I would say back or in is the first thing that pops your head. You can kind of see if a guy gets jammed. You can see if he hits it well, takes a big swing. Sometimes those are hard to see, big swing and hit off the end of the bat. But there's so many things that go into it. And just the more you really watch, I try to do it in BP every single day, is just watch guys swing and just see where pitch is at, see the ball flight. Is the ball top spun off the bat? Is it side spun? Is it back spun? Did he get everything into it? Like, there's just so many different factors that tie into that.
So you mentioned before the sun, the wind, things like that. What ballparks have been particularly challenging for you?
I mean, they're just all different. I wouldn't say challenging. Kauffman's probably my favorite because you don't really have to worry about running into anything that much. Some of the smaller parks are tough because going back on balls, you don't really have that much room. So you really got to get your eye off the ball and see where you're at as far as on the field and make sure you're not just running into anything. And no, I would just say they're different. I wouldn't say they're tough.
So I want to go through a player or two. And I figured I would start with a play that I figured that you would like. You went to college in Vegas. Bryce Harper's from Las Vegas. Last year, you stole a home run from him. Can you tell us the story of that?
Yeah, I think it was James McArthur was pitching. I believe it was the second pitch. He threw a curveball, and I knew he hit it pretty well right off the bat, but I had a really good beat on it. I was able to take my eye off the ball, and they have a shorter fence out there in straightaway center. And so I knew if I got back to the wall fast enough, if it carried more than I perceived it, I would have been able to get up on the wall, but I didn't really need to do that. And it's just diving in, really trusting yourself, what you do every single day and your BP, your first step, your reaction, and you just know where the ball is going to be at.
Looking at some of your other catches, I saw a good one against Matt Vierling at the end of last season, a good one crashing into the fence against Josh Rojas last year, a good one against Michael A. Taylor, who's the guy you replaced in center field, another against Oswald Peraza, where afterwards you slapped the fence, and a game-ending diving catch against Miles Straw, another pretty sick diving catch against Marcus Semien. Did I leave any out?
I don't know. You know, name some pretty good ones.
All right. So among those, which is your favorite?
I would say the Semien one was pretty good. I feel like I picked it right off the floor. There's some balls that you know right after your first step if you're going to get to it and if you're not going to get to it. And that was kind of one of the more iffy ones. Not sure if I was going to get there or not. I try my best to really, once a ball's been hit, don't look at the ball and try to get to the spot where I think it's going to be at, and then look back up again, and if it's there, make a play on it. Now, really challenging myself in BP is to see as far as when guys are hitting the ball, take my eye off it as long as I can and run to the spot. If it's there, you know, like, cool. If it's not, like, that's what you're learning from, you know, because in the game, like, the more you look at the ball, the easier it's going to be. So why not make practice harder?
We talked to Ian Happ last year, too, about diving catches in particular and getting under the ball and making sure that you're able to do that. Can you articulate on that for us?
I don't really think about getting under the ball or anything like that. Like, everything happens so fast. You're just making a play. Like, whatever happens, whatever body position you're in, like, that's just what's going to happen. You're on a lot of those crazy catches. You don't really have time to think of do different things. Just simply catch it.
I mentioned Josh Rojas before, and we talked to him last season about strength and conditioning to ready his body for playing for the whole year. What kind of strength and conditioning work do you do to get ready to play center field for a season?
This offseason looked a little bit different. I ran with Maurice Green. I did a bunch of sprint work with him.
The Olympian.
Yes. Basically rewiring my form. And I had some hamstring issues in the past and just rewiring it with him and just working on form. And it's really paying off. I feel like my legs are feeling pretty good.
What does that mean, working on your form? Like, are you straighter up? Is it a different kind of look?
Yeah. He called me like a backside runner. So basically my legs would get far behind me as I'm running. And he said everything should be working in front of you, like pistons. So his big thing is whatever you do with your upper body is controlling your lower body. So I would at times with a glove on run with my left arm down, not really thinking of it, but my legs would drag far behind me, and really working on my arms has helped my lower body a ton.
Besides Maurice Green, who are some people that have been big influences on how you play defense?
I really like to watch Byron Buxton. He's really good out there. Our outfield coach, Damon Hollins, he's doing all the fundamentals with me every single day, just getting like the basic ground balls, basic first step, reaction drills, and type of stuff like that. And that's what's really, really helped me out.
Is there a story behind your glove? We always ask players that.
Actually, the same glove I've been using since 2018. It's pretty beat up, but it's what's comfortable for me.
But it works?
Yeah, it works.
Do you have any particularly cool stories that are related to playing defense in the major leagues in any way? Like whether it was a welcome to the majors kind of moment or something that's happened where you're like, I'm going to remember that one for 50 years, that kind of thing.
Not really, no. It's just, going out there and playing every day. There's a new opportunity. I feel like I'm a perfectionist. So when I do miss balls or not take that right first step, I really watch film and get after it and see what I did wrong, see if my reaction, how my setup was, and just see and just fix everything. I can go after a BP tomorrow and figure it out.
Two more for you if I can. Bobby Witt Jr. joined us last year, and we talked to him a lot about the improvement that he made from his rookie year to his second year defensively. You had a pretty good view of it from where you stand. What is it like to watch Bobby Witt play shortstop these days?
No, it's pretty cool. He's obviously a super talented player and a great human being. But when I'm taking my first steps out there in center field, I feel like I'm kind of like a mirror of him. He's moving. If a guy fouls off a ball, he's taking those two steps to the right. And just it's expecting every ball is going to be hit to you. Like, you don't know which one's going to be hit to you, but it's expecting and assuming every ball is going to be hit to you. That's what he does, I feel like, so well. Anything in his range that he can reach, he's going after. Any foul ball, he's trying to get any pitch, he's trying to get a head start on it where he can see. And I think he's been so good over there that he gets so many balls. It's incredible to watch.
He's talked about how he was able to successfully slow the game down for himself his second year, which I imagine is the kind of thing that every major leaguer goes through. So let's close with this. There's a really cool video of you on YouTube where you explain the origin story of your tattoos. You're pretty well inked on your left arm. You've got a tiger. You've got one to commemorate your uncle. And you say you're done with tattoos. But hypothetically speaking, let's add one with a defense theme. What kind of tattoo art would you come up with to commemorate how you play defense?
That's a tough one. I would say I would get a lock. I just feel like lockdown. I don't know. That's just kind of what comes to me. Like when I go out there and play center field, if you hit the ball over here, you're out. Like it doesn't matter where it's at, where in this vicinity, like I'm going to lock it down. And that's just my mindset.
I think it's a lock where you're the only one who has the key.
Correct.
Kyle Isbell, thank you for taking the time to join us here on the Sports UFO Solutions Baseball Podcast. We'll be following you. Best of luck the rest of the year.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Our second guest today is baseball writer Daniel Epstein. Daniel is the co-director of the Internet Baseball Writers Association and a writer for Baseball Prospectus, who writes a lot of things that hit my interests. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
So the most recent of these pieces is a look at about 10 days worth of games for Mookie Betts playing shortstop. You watched and charted every player in a manner similar to what we do here. You had video examples for the different points that you wanted to make. What have you ascertained about Mookie Betts, the shortstop?
He's pretty good at it, from the best that I can tell. So first of all, let's just like talk about how amazing it is that he's even doing this. No one in baseball history has ever played 1,000 games in right field and then said, yeah, I'm going to be a middle infielder now on a full-time basis. This has never happened. There have been a handful of guys who played a lot of games at a middle infield spot and right field, but either they did middle infield first and then moved to the outfield, or they did it simultaneously, like Ben Zobrist. But the only two players that I could find in the history of the game that were outfielders for a significant period of time and then infielders were John Ward from the 1800s. It was a pretty great Sabre bio, by the way. I recommend reading up on him. So it's amazing that the Dodgers and Mookie were even like, yeah, we know you haven't done this in, I don't know, 10 years. Yeah, we're just going to make you our regular second baseman. And then in spring training, we're like, well, Gavin Lux isn't cutting it, so you're a shortstop now. And he was like, all right, let's do this. And not only that, but he seems like he's pretty good at it. So, you know, the caveat, of course, is that it's small sample. It's too early to look at really any metrics for defense for anything this early in the season. So I just watched all the plays, and observationally, he looks good at pretty much just about all of the things that you'd want an infielder to do.
Yep. Now, admittedly, he does have, by our data checking, 4 errors, 3 defensive misplays in 21 games. That's a little bit of a high pace, but we've found that you can survive something like that just if you're a very active playmaker, which it appears that he is. His defensive run save total is good. He's been good on the double plays so far. He's been solid overall. Is there any one thing that you particularly enjoyed watching about him?
Well, so I did notice that too. Like, he has had a handful of misplays. I'm not sure if that's just early season, it'll work itself out, or the fact that he's new at this because he hasn't really done it full time in a very long time. But the thing that impressed me most is that he really showed good range laterally, left and right. And I wasn't expecting that. I was also not really expecting his throws to be as on point as they are because, you know, obviously he has a great arm in right field. But throwing from right field is very different than throwing from shortstop. You know, in right field, usually you're trying to hit a cutoff man. And if you miss him by 5 feet, he just moves over and nobody even notices. If you are throwing from shortstop, ranging to your right in the hole, pivoting and throwing off balance with your momentum going the other direction and firing accurately to first base, you have to hit the vicinity of the first baseman. Otherwise, it's not an out, and it might even be an error. That has translated, so that was more than what I was expecting from him. But then again, I shouldn't have been surprised, because he's Mookie Betts. He's great at absolutely everything that he does, and I'm sure that that includes preparation as well. So you know that he's been working on these things.
Fielding Bible Award winner, including last year as a multi-position player for right field and second base. Now, you have a penchant for doing deep data dives on subjects, and you target things that, at least publicly, aren't measured. And there are two good examples of this that you've done the last couple of years. And I think for anyone that's listening, if you want to know how to do something like this, this is kind of a cool discussion to kind of think about that too. I want to talk about the most recent one. You spent 3 days over a weekend watching tag plays and invented a series of stats that you basically said, I wish these were tracked. What were some of the things that you found?
Yeah, so I can't say I necessarily recommend doing this because it is a massive time commitment. And your family will not be happy that this is how you're spending a 3-day weekend, just like watching random ground balls and, you know, throws on stolen base attempts or whatever. But, you know, I did it. So, like, I try and pick plays, like you said, that I feel like are not represented in at least public-facing defensive metrics, but still absolutely matter, such as tagging. If there's a stolen base attempt, right, the runner takes a lead, the pitcher kind of looks in his direction and then he starts his motion towards the plate. The runner takes off. The catcher receives the pitch, fires down to the base, and got him. He's out, right? The only guy who actually makes contact with the base runner is the middle infielder who applies the tag. And they aren't credited with any metric there, old school, new school, anything, at least that I could find publicly. They're just not, except for like, you know, a put out. And they do play a role there. Maybe it's not as important as the pitcher or the catcher, but they do have an important job. You know, if the throw isn't quite online, it's up to them to position themselves in such a way that they're able to grab the ball and apply the tag as quickly and accurately as possible. And not, and because that's an athletic skill, not all players are going to be able to do that equally well. Some are going to be better than others. I mean, we know that Javier Baez has had a number of different like highlight reel tags, which is pretty cool. But some are going to be better than others doing that. So some of the metrics that I kind of created, and by created, just saying like, hey, this would be cool. I don't have any like data saying who's actually good at this or who isn't. I just watched a bunch of video. And I'd like to see like tag route efficiency, who's going quickest from receiving the ball to tagging the runner, as opposed to like making a circular motion around their body or something. Tag speed, how quickly they can tag. I think tag probability is something that we could look at, you know, based on when someone receives a throw, how far away the runner is. We could probably, by we, I mean someone smarter than me, calculate how probable it is that someone's going to apply a tag accurately, just like we would do for a lot of other things like catch probability. So I'd like to see that for tags also.
Well, I will tell you that in the world of Sports Info Solutions, this is exactly the kind of thing that we are very into here, and our clients get bits and pieces of some of what you're talking about. It would be cool for it to be in the public sphere as well, certainly. So the other one, and this one really required a lot of work, and I want to say I'm kind of jealous because it's like the perfect kind of thing that I'd like to do, but at the same time, it's kind of like, whoa. You watch 10 first basemen catch 100 throws each to study stretching and scooping. That's 1,000 pieces of video. If you want to do this right, you got to watch 1,000 pieces of video. What did you find?
I found that my wife stayed with me, which the jury was out on that after I'm a teacher. I spent like my entire winter break just watching rounders and, you know, people throwing to first. But, you know, it was fascinating doing that because, again, like the throw to first from an infielder, all that the first baseman gets credit for is a put out. And they play a big role in whether or not it is a safe or an out, you know, especially on, you know, a ball bounces kind of like, you know, 5 feet in front of the first baseman. It's not really a short hop. It's something you expect a professional to handle, and then they don't, and the ball gets by them. Well, it's an E4 or an E6 or whoever threw it. And the first baseman doesn't get any credit or blame there whatsoever. They don't get credit for a good scoop. They don't get credit for missing one that they should have had. It just goes as an error to the thrower. That's especially frustrating, at least for me, when, like, you know, a shortstop makes a great diving play, jumps up, pirouettes, and makes a throw that beats the runner, but the first baseman just doesn't grab it, and it's an E6. You know what I mean? It's just one of the flukes of the way that official scoring has developed. But, you know, watching 1,000 ground balls, you really get an appreciation for, okay, like, who's good at this, and maybe who's not. So, I mean, I did this a few years ago. Some of these guys aren't even in the game right now. But the guy who really impressed me the most right there was Evan White, who was coming off his rookie year when I wrote this. And he had just won a gold glove. And I was like, wow, this guy is kind of revolutionary for the first base position. I was really impressed with the way that he always receives the throw at chest level. And he just lowers his body. Like, he'll get down on one knee to lower his chest so he can receive the ball at chest level. And I was like, you know, if I was a coach coaching young players, I'd be like, this is how you should play first base. I don't want you lowering your glove. I want you lowering your body and keeping your glove right in front of your chest because you have a higher probability of catching the ball. And I was saying at the end of the article, I was like, boy, I really hope this guy hits because it's fun to watch him play defense, and he has not hit. So Oh, wow.
But this is, I have a feeling that within teams, and this is where stuff gets very secretive, that teams are doing things and projects of a similar ilk. We've talked to Tucker Frawley for articles here with the Twins, and I know that he tracks a lot of different things. And it is cool when some of this info does seep out. And I think first base defense, I do want to make this point too. John DeJuan, I think, would agree with this, the inventor of defensive run saves. First base is the toughest position for us for defensive run save, just because we're mostly tracking the range aspect of it. We're looking at scooping throws, but it's not a hugely significant component. So I think there are definitely improvements to be made on the first base defensive evaluation side. I think you are onto something with the way that you did that work. Now, you don't just do defensive deep dives. Just to talk about your latest piece, you wrote recently about the split figure best ball, which we're going to talk about a little later in the show with someone else as well. And you found in particular one pitcher, Bryce Miller, has had some early success with it, adapting it, but a lot of other guys haven't. What have you found about the split figure best ball?
Yeah, you know, this was fascinating to me because a couple of months ago, that was the new end thing, right? You know, spring training was starting and everyone was like, hey, I worked on this new splitter. I'm going to try out this new splitter and it's going to be a big part of my arsenal. We saw a lot of articles about people written about like, hey, this guy's throwing a splitter now, watch out. And I was like, okay, how many of them have carried that into the regular season? Now that we're a couple of weeks in, starters have had, you know, a few starts by now. So who's throwing this splitter? And of all the pitchers who did not throw one last year and could have added one, I only found 10 who are actually throwing a splitter at least 2% of the time in the regular season this year. So the big takeaway of that for me is that adding new pitches is hard. It is not easy. And if you're going to do it, spring training is a good time to do it because you might find out that your new pitch sucks. You know, there it at least isn't up to the level that it needs to be to get batters out, or it's not as good as your pre-existing pitches. The only guy that I found who, and even of the 10 guys who added it, it wasn't all working for all of them necessarily. But the one guy who added it who was like, okay, this is an elite pitch and makes him a much better pitcher was Bryce Miller of Seattle. And that wasn't really a huge surprise because he desperately needed a splitter. He was like a two-pitch pitcher last year. Fastball, slider. They're great pitches, but if you're going to be a starting pitcher, you need something. You need an off-speed pitch. You need something to get lefties out, and he did not get lefties out last year. So he added a split finger. Now he's even better against lefties than he is against righties. He's having an awesome season so far. And using Baseball Prospectus's new pitch level metrics, Stuff Pro and Pitch Pro, turned out that they scored him -1.9 in each of those metrics on a splitter, which is elite. -2 is considered elite. He's right there. So he already picked up a splitter and was like, yep, this is one of the best in the game. And then if you just watch it, you can say, yeah, that looks like something that is unhittable. He's just locating it in such a way that it starts out, you know, and looks like it's a fastball low in the zone and then dives down in a way where a lefty is never going to be able to reach it. So he gets a lot of swings and misses on that. And it has taken him up a notch as a pitcher.
Watch Mookie Betts, watch Bryce Miller, and also watch how tags are made and watch how throws are handled at first base. Those are your takeaways if you read Daniel Epstein, which you should, at Baseball Prospectus and Forbes Sports Money as well. You can follow him on Twitter at dEpstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N, 1983, and at the IBWAA. And just to close, give us a quick plug for the IBWAA.
Sure. So the IBWAA, Internet Baseball Writers Association of America, the bottom line is, you know, we do a bunch of different things that try to promote and uplift writers and content creators in baseball. We have our newsletter, Here's the Pitch. Any IBWAA member is welcome and able to write for the newsletter and get paid percentage of what we make from it. You know, we try and move that forward to everybody. We promote people on social media. We're always looking to promote, like, people have big projects like books and things like that. And it's just about uplifting the writing community in any way that we can, because it's a pretty special thing to be able to create content. And, you know, people put a lot of themselves into it. So, you know, I'm proud of that work there. And I think that the best thing about us is that we're open to everybody. People ask, like, hey, am I eligible? You know, how do I join? And I'm like, everyone is welcome to be a part of us. If you think that you qualify, then so do we. So, you know, we're just trying to be open to everyone and bring people up.
Check them out on Twitter, as we said, IBWAA on Twitter. And one other thing to plug, I'll just mention it quick. Daniel is also a member of the Subway Ghosts, which is a baseball writers and mostly baseball statistics writers band, rock and roll, along with Davey Andrews of Fangraphs, Mike Petriello of Baseball Savant, and Mike Petriello of MLB.com, and Michael Clare of MLB.com. They get loud, they play fast. Enjoy their work. Follow them at the Subway Ghosts on Twitter. Daniel Epstein, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you got it. Thank you for having me.
And to close the show, we are joined by SIS ops analyst Brandon Tu, who has joined us a couple of times in the past, largely to talk international baseball. We're starting a new segment. We're going to bring some SIS folks on at the end of the show. Bobby Scales leaving the company. We're going to have different people come on, talk about just their job briefly. And also, I asked them to come up with 3 points. We'll come up with a name for this at some point. For now, I'm calling it Et Tu Brandon as a little tribute to Shakespeare. But hey, Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
So briefly, just give us an account of what you do at SIS and the kind of work that goes into what you do.
A typical day-to-day ranges from different tasks to be done. It could be anything from chart auditing MLB games to like deciding the MLB games from the day before, doing minor league data collection, doing international data collection, and then international pitch charting is something I'm big into and do a lot of that stuff. So the daily task ranges, but for the most part, my role is to help, you know, new video scouts who come in, and also to like kind of quality control, clean up the data, do all that kind of stuff for us. So yeah, that's it ranges in terms of what my job actually consists of on a daily basis, but there's a lot of different things. And I think that's why I like the job the most, is I get to watch a lot of different types of baseball. It's not just one type. There's a lot of different types.
Yeah, and Brandon's all over the place with his interests. We should let people know that he's watched every start made list, I think the last 2 years, by Yoshinobu Yamamoto and Roki Sasaki. He is all over the international information. We're going to talk international in a second. But all right, so 3 topics. Topic number one, you want to talk about something that we talked about previously on this podcast and that I got really excited about when you told me about it. Apparently, the University of Kansas is in the Big 12, a team that wasn't very good last year, closer to 500 in the league this year, is playing interesting defensively. They're doing something that I've been waiting for a team to do regularly. Tell us about what they're doing.
So Kansas is basically taking their second baseman and their third baseman and flipping them based off really the handiness of the hitter. So Cody Shojinaga, who's the second baseman, will flip to the third base side if it's a pull side hitter, so a lefty hitter. And then Michael Brooks, who they really like his range, he'll play the pull side. So it's kind of like Shojinaga plays the weak side and Brooks plays the pull side. And they do that for most of the game, and you can just see them flip across on video. The announcers like have picked up on it. I'm pretty sure Kansas coach has like told them, like, yeah, this is something we picked up from LSU. Like when we used to move guys over in infield shifts, like now we're just going to move Michael Brooks around because we really like his range. So yeah, that's kind of what they're doing, is they're giving Michael Brooks the most opportunity to make as many plays as he can.
Been waiting for this. I think I said this to Bobby a year or so ago, that I was waiting for the Blue Jays to take Matt Chapman and just put him wherever they thought that the ball was most likely going to be hit. And there are reasons for that. There are reasons against it. For Kansas, have you got a sense of whether it's working?
I think there's minimal gains and it's working. I think Michael Brooks is the better defender. That's not to say Shojinaga isn't a good defender, because they kind of move him all around the diamond. Like, he's played first base, he's played third base for them. But I think they like Michael Brooks' range. And what I have noticed about Kansas is they're really good at positionally like setting up their guys. So I don't know if they really need to move Michael Brooks over. But Michael Brooks has made a couple of really nice plays, like the April 7th game against West Virginia. He made a really nice play at second base. So yeah, I mean, he's really done a really good job of like kind of moving around and getting the best opportunities to make the most plays. I know Joe Maddon with the Cubs, like they used to move Javi Baez all around. And so it kind of makes sense. Like, if you have a really, really good defender, like, just move him all over diamond and see if you can make a bunch of plays.
Especially in a situation where you're fighting against some of the bigger boys in the league, and you have to do everything possible to gain any sort of an edge wherever you can. All right, stick to college baseball here for topic number two. You're very intrigued by the parity in the sport this year, not just among teams, but among players, and how wide open your favorite thing, the college draft, is this year in terms of who's going 1-1. So who are your contenders at this point?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Like, I was really high on Honeycutt, and I thought Vance Honeycutt, UNC center fielder, was going to be like a surefire top 10, top 5 pick this year. He's kind of fallen down the draft board. He's more of like a top 15 pick now. People are just worried about his head tool. But, you know, tools for days. But then there's guys like Charlie Condon who just hit at Georgia, and there's guys like Travis Bazana who just hit at Oregon State, second baseman for Oregon State. His hit tool is unreal. And J.J. Weatherholt, who's been hurt for most of the season, like, he's playing shortstop for West Virginia, and his hit tool, some people are saying he's the best amateur bat they've ever seen. So there's just a lot of different options. And then you got guys like Jack Caglione, who is probably the most talented baseball player in college right now. He's a two-way star at Florida, and he hits so many home runs. He hits the ball hard. And then you got guys like Brandon Montgomery, who's kind of like skyrocketed up the draft board. And, you know, he's got tools for days, and he's a transfer from Stanford to Texas A&M. And he's really taken off with like this Texas A&M team. They've taken off as he's gone. And then you got the pitching that like teams love the pitching. Like, they love Chase Burns. Chase Burns' metrics are incredible. Hagen Smith's slider is unreal. Like, you could go a lot of different ways. There's probably like seven guys who could go 1-1, but there's probably a tier of like five or four guys.
Only one will, though. Yeah, and you're the king.
Only one will.
You're the king of hype here. I tell you, you have to make a pick. Who you taking of those guys?
If I had to make a pick today, I would go Travis Bazana. And it's just because I think the consistency of him as a hitter, and I know what I'm going to get. I know he's a second baseman. That's really probably where he's going to play as a second baseman. But if I can get the level of power production he can give you at the second base spot, and then also his just hit tool, I just think it's different. And I really like J.J. Weatherholt. I think it's between those two in terms of, like, if you had to ask me today, I would pick one of those guys, and I'd probably go Travis Bazana right now just because I like the power a little bit more than Weatherholt. But, man, Weatherholt's bat. I mean, some people grade it as a 70. Like, it's that good. His hit tool was unreal. So I could see both of those guys. But I really like the tools, man. Like, the tools of Caglione and Montgomery and Honeycutt. I mean, I saw a mock draft where Honeycutt might go to the Dodgers. Like, if Honeycutt goes to the Dodgers and they get him to, like, an average hitter in the big leagues, like, forget about it. He's playing Gold Glove center field, stealing 30, 40 bases a year, and an average hitter, you're going to take that every day of the week.
So, thumbs up on Kansas, thumbs up on Bazana as the number one potential pick,
yeah.
Thumbs up potentially on Honeycutt falling to the right team, as you just said. Last topic. All right, NPB pitchers, there's the need to throw both a changeup and a splitter or different breaking balls, and NPB pitcher is becoming more trendy to the idea of spinning the ball in different ways. You're someone who watches as much NPB as anyone in this country. What are you seeing?
Yeah, thanks for the shout out. That's probably accurate.
It is.
Yeah, they spin the ball a lot, and I think that's something that Major League Baseball has started to like latch onto. Like, Yu Darvish said a while ago that the sweeper was already over there in Japan. Like, guys were throwing that all the time. And now it's kind of making its way over here. What I find fascinating is the need to throw a changeup and a splitter to get like different spin profiles and different like looks for a hitter. And I think it has to do with MPB hitters over there just do not whiff and miss. They do not strike out. They put the ball in play. They foul the ball off. You're not going to throw a fastball by them. So you have to find other ways to get them out. And I just think it's fascinating because I know that you've had people on who's talked about like the year of the splitter and like the splitter's coming to like MLB because it's the best pitch in baseball. And I think that's accurate. Like, I think guys are going to start leaning on splitters. But I find it fascinating that MPB pitchers, like if you watch a team, most of those guys throw a splitter and then, you know, the starters will throw splitters and changeups, or they'll throw a sweeper and a slider. There's guys who throw cutters, sliders, and sweepers. A slow breaking ball and a slower one. It's just crazy how much spin there is. And like, I just find that fascinating as like a philosophy of how to pitch. And I don't think the high forcing has gotten to MPB yet. I don't think that's something that they throw regularly. Really, the only guy I can think of who throws it is Cebu Lions pitcher Kai Matiera. He throws a high forcing like a lot. Like, that's basically where he throws his forcing. But he still throws 8 pitches. Like, he still throws different, like, arm angles. He brings the ball in different spots. And it's just interesting because, like, I think guys just feel like they have to do something different to get swing and miss. But then you see guys like Imanaga come over this year. He slimmed down his arsenal. He's throwing 4 pitches, really, and 3 pitches, to be honest. And he's throwing 67% fastball. And it's just like, yeah, I get it. Like, if your fastball is that good, throw it. But I don't know. I feel like in MPB, there's a lot of like emphasis on like spinning the baseball and just doing a lot of different things. And it's really cool to watch because guys can throw anything within a given at bat. And it's kind of weird to watch.
Six or seven different pitches. It seems to me, I'm just thinking about someone from the States that would probably have thrived over there. Like Ubaldo Jimenez throws so many different pitches. He would have fit in perfectly there. We're seeing pitchers come in who throw a lot of different types of things. You see, I would imagine Yu Darvish is one of the hardest pitchers for people to chart back when we, in terms of when we chart pitches. Brandon Tu, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
And this wraps up this episode. You can follow us on Twitter at @SIS_baseball and read our work at sportsinfosolutions.com. For Kyle Isbell, Daniel Epstein, Brandon Tu, and Justin Stein, I'm Mark Simon. Thank you for listening to the Sports Info Solutions Baseball Podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to the SIS Baseball Podcast. If you like the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. If you have any questions, email the show at mark@sportsinfosolutions.com or tweet us @sportsinfo_SIS.